This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This spring, graduation ceremonies at the University of Pennsylvania were preceded by racially separate events for Black, Latino, and Asian seniors. Other schools like Vanderbilt University, Washington University in St. Louis, and the University of Michigan also held special ceremonies to recognize Black graduates. Many other schools have similar events for their Latino and Asian students. The schools involved believe that these ceremonies help celebrate diversity. Some critics claim they help separate the races. As we look ahead to the Supreme Court decision on the University of Michigan case, which revolves around affirmative action, we also need to discuss a related issue. Once diversity is achieved in a university or anywhere else, how do people behave when they study and work together? The reality is that members of different races often segregate themselves in high school lunchrooms, in college student unions, at parties, fraternities, and sororities. Legal desegregation seems to have little effect on social separation of the races. Later in the program, a man who's analyzed violence and peace talks, how different kinds of groups can try to undermine the talks and what negotiators can do to stay on track. Plus, the much-hyped Segway scooter and why it's off to such a rocky start. But first, social segregation. Why do we congregate in racial groups? Do schools encourage this voluntary segregation by holding Black-only or Latino-only events? What does voluntary segregation say about affirmative action? What's happening where you go to school, or for that matter, where you work? Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our first guest studies why students segregate and how often they do it. James Moody is a professor of sociology at Ohio State University. He joins us now from his office in Columbus. And thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Neil. I appreciate you being on the show.
Researchers have actually tried to measure the degree to which high school students self-segregate. What have they found out?
Well, using high school students, you find that relative to the opportunity for making cross-race friends, high school students are about 1.8 times as likely to make same-race friends as opposed to cross-race friends. So almost twice as likely to choose within race as opposed to across race.
What do we know about why this happens?
Well, there are a number of reasons why. I think that the first and most basic reason why has to do that we like to be with people who are like ourselves across a lot of different activities. So we like to be with people who play the same sports that we do, listen to the same music we do, and so forth. And so a lot of the things that we pick up on in terms of race segregation are often activity segregation. So the same research, for example, that shows that kids are about twice as likely to segregate on race, shows that once you account for those types of similarities, the racial segregation is about 1.3 times as likely. So a lot of that difference has to do with those kinds of activities.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there are two other sort of major reasons for why kids segregate. The other one has to do with the racial composition of the school as a whole. So when you have a school that is basically split into two races, it's very easy to get us versus them type dynamics in the school. You have one group of kids who can possibly fight with the others or what have you. Our research tends to show that when the racial diversity gets much richer, when you get three, four, five racial groups in a school, a lot of mixed-race kids in a school, that the amount of racial heterogeneity doesn't predict segregation. You sort of reach a tipping point where these kind of segregation things go away because no single group can dominate. And finally, I think the third reason that you get segregation has to do with the climate of the school itself. And there are sort of three various things inside that matters. Tends to be, I think, the most important one has to do with the extent to which kids cooperate between races. So if you have bands and choruses and stuff that are racially integrated, then people of different races see each other working together, and that kind of cooperative interaction tends to lead for more cross-race interaction.
A lot of people have suggested that indeed extracurricular activities like that can actively help discourage segregation.
Yes, I think that's a very good point. Our research shows that in schools where the extracurricular activities are integrated, you end up finding many more cross-race friends, and not just among the kids who are on teams together, but even kids who aren't involved in extracurricular activities. When they see that there are people mixing together on these sports teams and these other activities, it generates a school climate where you get more cross-race friends.
Your work is obviously in high school. I wonder, has there been work to find out whether this changes as kids go through, elementary, middle school, and into high school?
You do tend to find that there is a greater a level of segregation as you end up higher in the grade range, at least from junior high through to high school. But I think this has more to do with the change in the the classroom structure than anything else. You find in schools where kids are really forced to pick their friends from the same grade, where they don't mix across different types of activities, that they really don't have the opportunity to self-segregate in the same way. So elementary kids are forced usually to be in one small classroom all day with the same kids, and so they don't have the opportunity to select kids of their own race to the same degree that if you put all the kids in the school in one particular room. So you get into high school where their schedules allow them to mix more freely, you end up with more self-segregation than you do in the younger grades.
Do you see any benefit to social segregation? Some educators argue it can be important for minority groups, and I guess depending on the school, certainly the minority could be white.
I've heard those arguments. I tend not to be so convinced by them. Some work that we're doing now shows that one of the best predictors of whether or not kids are afraid at school has to do with the racial segregation of friendships. So it's not how racially heterogeneous the school is, but how segregated their social lives are. And in schools where kids are really socially segregated, they tend to be, and this is early work, but they tend to be more afraid at school.
Okay. Can you take a call with us?
Sure.
Joining us now is Becky, who's on the line from Gaston, Oregon.
Hi, Becky.
Hi, Becky. You're on the air.
Hi. I was a high school teacher, and I noticed that there was a lot of segregation in our school. Our school is really racially diverse. There was about a third of the kids were from European backgrounds, like a long time ago. About a third were Asian, and a third were either black or Southeast Asian, like Thai or Indian or different things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked some of the kids why they kind of just hung around in racial groups, because they're really friendly with each other in class, but they just, it never stuck in the cafeteria or anywhere outside. And one of the girls said that it was because of things outside of school that their parents would or wouldn't let them do. Some of the Chinese families, for example, their parents were really strict, and so they could never go to the parties that the other kids were having. And so the friendships never went beyond the classroom because of their families and their cultures.
That's interesting. James Moody, get a response to that, and specifically the question, did you find that social segregation continued outside of class in the kinds of things Becky's talking about, parties and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I don't have data per se to ask whether or not these are, where these friendships are formed, though the kids were allowed to nominate friends, from wherever they've made their friends.
Mm-hmm.
I think her explanation fits perfectly with what we know about how friendships form. If you don't have the opportunity to hang out with each other, then you're less likely to form relationships. So, I think her explanation is a good one, and I think it raises a deeper issue about what schools can do. I think that we need a cooperation between schools and families and communities to help provide the opportunities for kids of different races to interact with each other.
Becky, I wonder if you saw the other side of the coin in groups of kids who had integrated extracurricular activities, whether it was the band or the chess club or whatever. Did they tend to form friendship groups among themselves?
They were actually the only exception where kids on sports teams and kids in the choir were pretty diverse in their friendships, and they had pretty close friendships because their extracurricular activities were kind of all together.
Mm-hmm. James Moody, that would fit right in with your...
It makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Becky. Appreciate it. Let's get another caller in, and this is Curtis, who's on the line with us from Fort Lauderdale.
Hi there. How are y'all today?
Okay.
I'm a high school history teacher. I teach U.S. history, and I've taught in the public school now for some years. I teach in a private school right now. And it has been my experience that, as the gentleman says, that students are more likely to sit with students of their like color. And it's really a matter of the old saying, I think, birds of a feather flock together. And it's not right, wrong, good, or bad necessarily. It's just the students with whom they seem to have more in common. And the other thing I find is that there seems to be a discerned double standard. Where the students who are Anglos tend to feel that the African American students and other minorities do things that if they were to do them, they would be easily perceived as racist. Student organizations that are really intended for the African American community, United Negro College Fund, and so on, and they think if there were a white organization like that, then it would be easily perceived as being racist. So that's my experience. I don't see any hostility between the races at all, but it does seem that they tend to separate themselves socially, voluntarily.
Okay. Thanks very much, Curtis.
Thank you.
James Moody, what is wrong then with allowing this situation, if that's what the kids choose, to persist?
Well, I think there are a couple of points to be made. First is that even if you try to account for all of the kinds of things that make people sort of birds of a feather, there's still segregation above and beyond that. So even if you control for being on the same kids, clubs, and these various types of activities that they're interested in, you still find that kids segregate more than you would expect otherwise. And I think that sort of extra level of over-segregation, sort of above and beyond the kinds of things we do, so the color of our skin above as opposed to the nature of our character, that's the kind of segregation that I think we should be concerned about. So we shouldn't surprise us that I think the gentleman's absolutely right. It shouldn't surprise us to find some level of segregation because of the types of music we listen to and the kinds of movies we like to watch and these kinds of things. It's when it goes above and beyond that we might have reason for concern. And to the extent that segregation above and beyond that really is somehow not voluntary, or, on the other hand, a response to perceived inequalities or perceived status differences or perceived levels of threats or danger, then we need to be worried. And I think that we can, again, I think there are some evidence that suggests that in schools where there is this kind of social segregation, we do find greater levels of fear, we do find greater levels of violence. And these kinds of questions that we need to ask ourselves, again, it's not certain, but is it the case that this segregation is leading to these kinds of outcomes? And if so, we need to really be careful and look to try to correct it.
James Moody, thanks very much.
Thank you.
James Moody, a professor of sociology at Ohio State University, was with us from his office in Columbus, Ohio. And joining us now is someone who thinks having a diverse campus is not enough, but that to truly integrate, schools must also be proactive. Sylvia Hurtado is associate professor of higher education at the University of Michigan and director of the Center for the Study of Higher and Post-Secondary Education. She's with us from her home in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and it's good of you to join us today.
Thank you very much.
Currently, Michigan is one of those universities that holds separate graduation ceremonies for its black students. And I wanted to read a quote to you from James McWhorter, who's a critic. The fact that these ceremonies are so prevalent nicely shows, he writes, that the common defense of racial preferences, that it puts whites and blacks on the same campus to learn about and become comfortable with each other, is senseless. On the contrary, he writes, campuses are precisely where many black students learn a new separatist conception of being black that they didn't have before.
In response to that,
yeah,
my reaction essentially is, well, you have to think that these graduations did not begin, or these activities didn't begin because the institution willed them to occur, but students actually got together and said, we'd like to celebrate, finishing up and bring our families together to meet each other and coming from across the country or different parts of Michigan, we want them to come together, and that's basically what the students actually decided to do. And so, as a result, the institution decided to support them in their interest in putting the celebration together. So these graduations are not replacing the general graduation. Everyone participates in that. The stadium is full. Everyone who's finishing up, graduate students and undergraduates, are together, and that is, important. So the celebration part is something that I think these institutions historically have not really had some celebrations for various groups, and so this actually came as an initiative from students.
And it's something that the university celebrates?
Well, the university, in terms of supporting the students that feel that they want to bring their families together, and yes, they will. They'll support that.
We're talking about social segregation, what it is and why it happens. Our guest is Sylvia Hurtado. We're going to take more of your calls and emails when we come back from a break. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about social segregation. Do you see it happening at your school or where you work? Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Sylvia Hurtado, Associate Professor of Higher Education at the University of Michigan. And I wanted to ask you, Sylvia Hurtado, it's obviously not wrong for people of the same race to want to sit together. Are there benefits to your view?
Well, to a certain extent, I think part of the benefits is I think all of us as human beings feel like we want to be familiar and comfortable with others who share the same interests. And so I think that allows us some time of the day to come together with others who are like us, particularly for minority students who actually may spend most of their day interacting across race, mm-hmm. in classrooms and outside of classrooms, to find a time to, you know, chat with someone who is much like them. So this is a natural thing. It happens for not just minority students, but also white students, and they form the peer groups. And this is an important part of their development during college, this identity development.
Here's an email we got from, I'm trying to look for the name here, Lynn in Denver. Here it is. Mm-hmm. It's been 30 years since I left my 99.9% black local high school to attend a 99% white university 1,000 miles from home. In a dormitory of several hundred young students, we seven black students did make it a point to take dinner together. It simply made us feel more comfortable, as did other frequent socialization with a couple of other dozen black students on campus. All of us had white friends as well, and many of us were active participants in college life. I heard then, as I did now, a certain amount of resentment from white students that we would choose each other's company. One white student who found an all-black dinner table objectionable and obviously was sensitive to the isolation issue solved the problem very neatly. He came over, introduced himself, and joined us for dinner. Is that the kind of situation that you're talking about? But 30 years ago, obviously, the situation was, at least in most campuses, dramatically different from what it is today.
No, absolutely. I think that there have been some dramatic changes. And as the previous speaker was talking about, those that are more culturally rich, actually, there's more mixing going on, more students who actually share experiences across different racial ethnic groups and also likes and dislikes and interests. So that's possible in a more diverse campus. But I also think that we have to kind of overcome intentionally some of the familiarity and the comfort levels to really kind of cross the bridges if we expect students to learn how to develop a pluralistic view of the world or participate in a pluralistic democracy where difference is encountered on a whole range of issues. So on the other side of both saying, yes, students need to have this comfort, this area of identity development with other students, there's also, I think, as educators, we also have to give them opportunities to cross these bridges across various social groups. And I think that's where we have to be intentional.
Let's get another caller involved. Kenneth joins us on the line from Modesto, California.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I always find it ironic that we have these sorts of discussions, and I believe that the reason why we find such segregation, where the students decide to sit together, is because I don't believe that there's any national emphasis on we're all the same race, the human race. Mm-hmm. Like when I was telling your screener that, you know, I grew up in Chicago on the South Side, and I never knew anyone that was not black until I joined the military. I got in the military. My roommate, one was Filipino, one was a white guy, and there was another black guy in my room, and me and the black guy didn't gravitate towards each other. I, you know, became very, very good friends with everyone in my room, and I was intrigued with, you know, other races because I'd never been exposed to that. I never really had been discriminated against, so, you know, I simply, I live in California now, and, I mean, please, I have more ethnically diverse friends than I do black friends, and it's not, you know, it's only because I look at everyone as a person and not as a race. And I believe that we should have a national campaign that says, you know, we're all the same race, the human race. Hmm. I believe that would go far in changing. changing a lot of these stereotypical behaviors.
Or as the Army put it, Kenneth, everybody here is just one color green.
That's absolutely correct, and that made a lot of sense because we were all in the same boat.
Go ahead, please.
Oh, well, I was going to say that I think one of the issues that actually makes these groups come together is having a common goal, and I think that might be probably more important than emphasizing de-emphasizing differences. That is, you know, that we're not different from each other, because in the sense we are, in terms of coming from different income backgrounds and cultural backgrounds, and that is what we hope to celebrate in America by understanding what those differences bring and the contributions it brings. So what really unifies a group, I think, particularly in the military, but there are other, we also know that from other research, that having common goals to work toward as a group actually is one of the ways to actually have a lot of interaction and also learning occur.
But if I could interject, don't you believe that if our government, we've got these anti-drug campaigns, these anti-smoking campaigns, this buckle your seatbelt campaign, what about the we're all of the same race, the human race, and develop that same goal that we're not trying to separate ourselves and celebrate our differences, but celebrate our humanness.
Right.
Don't you believe that if children was bombarded with that sort of message from an early stage, that by the time they did get to college and the high school, that would be what they would be, that was one of the points that they would understand, that it doesn't matter that, you know, we have a different skin hue or we come from different economic backgrounds, that we're all of the same race, the human race.
Well, I think that Campaign for Equality would be a wonderful thing, and that's exactly what we would hope we could achieve. But we have to work on some of the, you know, problems that keep us unequal in terms of...
But we're not talking about equality. We're talking about the reality. These differences that we seem to celebrate are what's keeping us separate. We need to understand that we're all... If we, like the president said once, if we were attacked by some alien race, then it would become clear to us that we're all human. We're not these ethnic segmented, you know, people. We're just all human beings. And once we understand that, and once we seem to try to get message across, I believe that we'll go a long way to separating these boundaries that are put up.
Kenneth, I don't mean to stereotype people who are from California, but I hear running water. You're not calling us from a hot tub, are you?
No, I would like to be in a cold tub. It's about 100 degrees today.
Well, Kenneth,
thank you again for taking my call.
I appreciate it, Kenneth. Appreciate it. Let's go now to John, who's on the line with us from Denver, Colorado.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to sort of limit my comments. I know this is Race in America, a very extensive topic, but about... Do universities have a right and an obligation to offer events for the minority students? I'm an Asian American. I grew up in a lily white suburb. Mm-hmm. I felt that I was very well assimilated, almost too assimilated. And then when I, as an incoming freshman, my university offered a minority student orientation, which I participated in a week prior to the other students coming. And I think during that week, I discovered sort of my ethnic roots. I met other minority students who I never had interacted before. I met other Asian students for the first time, and I think it was a very valuable experience, and I think the university had every right and an obligation to offer me those opportunities, and I don't see that as segregation as so much an opportunity for me to discover a part of myself, and I think it was a very positive experience.
And Sylvia, that's a lot of the argument that you're hearing around this University of Michigan case that's up at the Supreme Court.
Yes. Well, absolutely. I think that one of the things that diversity does is it allows us to begin to understand who we are in relation to others, and that is an important part of identity development, but also helps us to understand more about ourselves and how we're regarded, how our various groups emerge, the histories, the cultural legacies that constitute America. So I think that is really, I think that's probably one of the most important experiences that a student can have, coming from either a racially homogeneous environment or coming from a predominantly white environment, to come and discover with other students who are at the same stage, so that there's more of an equal status kind of situation going on, to actually understand and learn together.
And I think if I could just add that I think if you're going to value diversity on the campus, the university or somebody has to place value on the diversity. So I don't think that comes from just having people of mixed races and backgrounds co-mingling on a campus. I think the university has to take a very proactive stance and say, we're going to celebrate, you know, Afro-American activities 1 month and Asian-American activities another, and really give those diverse elements value. Otherwise, it'll just be, lip service.
Well, some campuses are also going a bit further and then using cooperative learning in the classroom so that you have the pedagogy that allows students to interact with each other and share those experiences. There are these intergroup relations programs now going on a variety of campuses, some major public universities, where students are learning more about the existing stereotypes and how to break them down and build common goals. And then there's also the service learning movement that's really swept the country in terms of getting involved in the communities in need and basically creating real social change agents of students to go out and become the bridges across these various gaps in our society.
Okay. And it's always going to be controversial because even when we were going through it, the white students, the predominant complaint was, well, why are they here early? Why are they self-segregating? I think that's always going to be an ongoing debate. I think it's very difficult for us to put value on diversity and in our minority community without, in some level, having the majority feel threatened by that. And I completely understand that. But I think at some level, I think it has tremendous value, and I think we should try to look past the segregation aspect and look at the value of it.
Yes.
John, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Micah Pollack joins us now. She's an assistant professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. She's working on a forthcoming book called Color Mute, and she argues that part of the problem with race relations is our inability to talk to each other about race. She's with us from her office in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, thanks.
Color Mute sounds very much like you're saying we're not able to talk to each other.
Right. The color muteness is a term that I've coined to describe the active deletion of race labels from everyday talk and also policy talk. And I'm contrasting it to colorblindness with the argument that in a society that has thought of itself racially and organized itself racially for centuries, it's really an illusion to think that people can't see race, and that it's much more accurate to say that people are often color mute, meaning refusing to label people
racially. Give us a for instance.
This is based on about 3 years of research on everyday struggles over race talk in California in a high school in its district. And I found this can happen, by the way, in both homogenous and desegregated communities. But people deleting race words, especially in public, race labels, basic labels like white, like black, like Latino, Asian, when talking about certain charged topics, inequality, social relations. Ironically, social relations between students is often much easier for us to talk about than social relations between students and the adults around them.
Hmm. So, but when you mean, Rob, you know, not describing somebody as black?
Yes. That the active deletion of a race label from the way one describes the world is what I'm calling color muteness. So the same action would happen when a university decides to delete race labels from its applications, which is what is happening with the dismantling of affirmative action plans. To me, that's also a color mute move in that it's actively refusing to label people racially. And in my own analysis, that refusal has many problematic consequences.
Such as?
Well, it has different consequences at different levels. At the policy level, it can be problematic because it shuts down a conversation on the continuing role race plays in unequal opportunity before admissions. Between students, being color mute can shut down important questions like how does race matter to social relations here on our campus? For example, a very important conversation that a diverse community that talks successfully about race can have is one such as how were opportunities to learn distributed in our lives before we got here, and how are they distributed here on this campus? And I found in my own classes that when students are sort of mentored to talk successfully about race and in racial terms, you can have very successful conversations about race that open up all kinds of important further conversations about the structure of inequality, the sort of role of race in American society, and a diverse community that can talk successfully about race is, I would argue, the best setting for the most productive conversations about how race matters in American society, which is a crucial conversation that I'm arguing for in the book.
Micah Pollack, and also with us Sylvia Hurtado. We're talking about self-segregation, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Sylvia Hurtado, I was wondering if you just, this theory may be as new to you as it is to me. I wondered if you get a reaction to it.
Well, certainly. I think that it's entirely clear that there is probably a movement across the country in terms of not talking about race, when really that is clearly one of the issues that's, you know, that's on the table. In other words, that trying to ignore it at every cost, really, when, you know, this country actually had a civil war over race issues, and we continue to have difficulty in intergroup relations and conflicts and various types of settings, including schools. So essentially then, you know, we have to take into account race in order to actually begin a corrective. We have to understand that this is part of our history, and once we do that, I think we can have productive discussions about race. But to ignore it actually kind of mutes the issue, just as you know, Professor Pollack has said, and actually you know, makes things go underground, you know, in other words, not really being upfront about some of the issues that are really coming to the fore. And I think really some of the issues that the campuses are dealing with now is really bringing these issues forward so that students have the opportunity to ask the questions, to get their stereotypes out on the table, and to have some productive discussions about how do we move beyond this as a country.
Sylvia Hurtado, thanks very much for being with us today.
Welcome.
Sylvia Hurtado is an associate professor of higher education at the University of Michigan, director of the Center for the Study of Higher and Post-Secondary Education, and she was with us from her home in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Micah Pollack, appreciated listening to your ideas as well.
Thanks very much for having me.
I'll take a look at that book when it comes out. It sounds
great.
Very interesting.
Thanks.
Micah Pollack is an assistant professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. She's working on a book called Color Mute, which is due out next year, and she was speaking with us from her offices in Cambridge, Massachusetts. When we come back, we will turn our attention to the issue of violence and how it can affect peace negotiations. Also later in the program, we'll be talking about Ginger. Yes, the Segway scooter introduced with so much hype. Where is it now? Not on a sidewalk near you. Not most likely. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Back in a couple of minutes. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.